Okay, that should be it. Good evening, welcome to, you know where you are, the Jewish Theological Seminary, right? Welcome to another one, and in this case it's actually the second of the year, though it feels like the first of the year since there's been a long holiday and hurricane period in between. As many of you know, the library has in recent years been sponsoring a series of book talks, mostly by JTS faculty, though we've invited some others in as well. And this has been a way of enriching our collective culture and drawing attention to significant new books, both by faculty and by others. And, of course, as a library, we care a lot about books. So that's what we want, why we want to make sure and bring them to you. Alan has been kind enough to present in this forum in the past, we're pleased that he's back again. The book concerning which he will be speaking, as you know, Short History of Jewish Ethics, was available to people like you and me, that is to say to those of us in the U.S. market, months ago, at early 2012. And I can tell you that I purchased my copy of the book upon its release in this country, for a variety of reasons, including the fact that I was looking forward to planning a course in Jewish ethics, and it's something that's interested me for a very long time. And I've always been frustrated and puzzled by the whole challenge of what it would mean to do Jewish ethics and what are the sources that are relevant to doing Jewish ethics. So there are a few people in this room who actually know that I have assigned this book, or at least sections of the book, as introduction to several courses that I have taught relating to questions of ethics. I just want to share two things with you in terms of substance. First, the challenge that any of us who are involved in thinking about Jewish ethics would face, and that is that Jewish ethics seldom presents itself as in an official philosophical form. One must ferret it out of legal texts, stories, commentaries, wise sayings, and so on. If one looks for Jewish ethics in a form comparable to that of Western philosophical treatise, one will find very little. That absence makes it very difficult to identify what it is we want to read at all when we're asking the questions that ethics asks. Alan, in his inimitable way, offers a very simple answer to the question of what Jewish ethics is or might be. Here I'm reading from page 7. I suggest that an historical inquiry into Jewish ethics attend to Jewish reflection on conduct and character. Jewish reflection on conduct and character. In this very brief book, you will therefore have not only a history of Jewish reflection on conduct and character, but in some measures a history of Jewish thought, a history of Jewish literature, a history of Jewish writers who are writing about the way Jews ought to conduct their lives and affairs, and other things besides. You could hardly do better, in considering the range of Jewish literature and Jewish thought, Jewish philosophical history, then taking as the focus question, what does Judaism teach about conduct? And that's what you'll find beautifully laid out in this book. I've already said enough, though, about this. By saying what I have, I just mean to communicate my enthusiasm for the book and sense of why it's important. You can easily buy it still online, I assume. And I will allow Professor Middleman of our faculty to now go the directions that he'd like before we open to discussion.
Thank you very much, David. I'm grateful to Professor Kramer and to Hector Guzman for arranging this event, and I'm beyond grateful to you for coming. I was pretty much convinced that no one would be here, not only because of the dreadful climate situation, but because of last night. I mean, if you were like me, you got to bed very late, very early, and maybe had too much to drink. And yet here we are. Let me tell you a little bit about how this book came to be. And then, because I think that story is just unusual. And then I'll try to bring you into the subject matter of the book by pursuing some of the questions that that David Kramer has raised. There's a lot of content in the book, but there's a lot of philosophical methodology as well, because this issue of what is Jewish ethics, how would you go about constituting that concept and making it heuristic inclusive, but not overly inclusive. There's a lot of work that has to be done on the conceptual side before you even get to study anything. So, talk about that. When I was in graduate school, around about 1976, I read a book, Exhibit A, called A Short History of Ethics by the famous philosopher Alistair MacIntyre. And I remember reading this book one summer, 1976, when I was a security guard at Saks Fifth Avenue on the main line outside of Philadelphia. I remember standing out there reading this, my little uniform on. And I was, this is a history of Western ethics, basically from Homer through Bertrand Russell. Yeah. And I remember asking myself, is it possible to discern something that we could call Jewish ethics and to write a comparable philosophically astute history of it from its biblical manifestations, or as I would put it now, from Leviticus to Levinas? You know, could you do it? Could you do it? I wondered back in 1976. About 4 years ago, I was walking to Shul. I'm pretty sure it was on the second day of Sukkot. And I was just pretty much done with my book, Hope in the Democratic Age. And I was starting to think about, oh, what do you want to do next? What kind of grows out of that? What do you want to probe? And I said, well, you never really answered that question that you raised back in graduate school. What would a history of Jewish ethics look like? What is there that you'd write a history of? I mean, how would that work? So I'm walking the shul, I'm thinking about these questions. It's about a half-hour walk. And, that evening, I turned on the computer. I checked my email, I hadn't looked at it in a couple of days. And out of the clear blue sky, no context whatsoever, is an email from the religion editor of Blackwell Publishers in Oxford, England, saying, we would like to commission an introduction to Jewish ethics, and your name has been suggested to us as someone who would be well positioned to write that. Would you be interested? I almost fell off my chair. What is one to think? Under those circumstances, you have to accept that offer, right? I mean, no choice. So then, over the next couple of months, the real work began, because I had to draft a proposal for the press and for their anonymous peer reviewers and make kind of argument for what an introduction to Jewish ethics in a historical mode should look like. So what I'd like to kind of discuss with you is the thinking that issued into that proposal and then subsequently into the book. As David said, if you want to study Western ethics, there's a canon. You know, there are classics. There are places to go. We know the dialogues of Plato that are most full of moral philosophy. You know, you could, if you want to study courage, you go to the Laches. If you want to study justice, you go to the Republic. If you want to study love, you go to the Symposium. You know where to go. We know where to go in Aristotle. I mean, of course, you wouldn't only go to the ethics, you'd go to the politics too. And of course, you have to go to the metaphysics as well. It's all connected. But there's a book called The Nicomachean Ethics, and there's another book by Aristotle about ethics as well. There are places to go. If you're in the Middle Ages and you go to Aquinas, there's a whole section of the Summa that's on the virtues. You go there. Where you go in Jewish sources, in the little line that he read, you know, they don't wear, the texts don't wear uniforms announcing, you know, what team they belong to. There's no easy way of knowing how to find Jewish ethics. So the very basic question, how do we constitute Jewish ethics? I made the decision to kind of follow philosophical practice. In conventional language, we use ethics and morals pretty much interchangeably, unless we want to be really redundant and say ethics and morals, which I don't like. That always brings my red pen out when I see that. I mean, you know, take your pick. But they basically mean the same thing. But in philosophical language, they don't mean the same thing. In philosopher speak, morals is the raw material for the philosophical reflection that constitutes ethics. So ethics is a branch of philosophy. It's the branch of philosophy that analyzes in a logical and critical, exquisitely rational way human conduct. Think about it analogously to art and aesthetics. Aesthetics is the branch of philosophy that deals with art. Art is the content for aesthetic criticism, reflection, construction, systematization. We're not entirely sure what art is. It's not like you have some fixed content sitting there and you bring your philosophical tools to it and start cutting it up and taking it apart. What counts as art is partly constituted by your aesthetic theory. And how your aesthetic theory works is partly constituted by what you choose to analyze. Same with ethics and morality. So these are kind of fluid terms, but it seems to me that there's some advantage for Jewish ethics in holding on to the philosophical sense of ethics as a meta-level reflection on something that is more primary. It's not unreflective in and of itself. It's not like natural science where you may be studying rocks or metal conductivity or something like that, because we're dealing with human agents, and human agents make up their minds about why they do what they do. So even at a primary level, there's a level of reflection and recursivity built into the primary matter. I think then what it means to look for Jewish ethics is to look at texts that deal with normative matters and to look at those texts in a philosophical vein to see what the implicit argument is that the text is making. What are the questions the text raises? How do these questions relate to questions perhaps raised in a Platonic text or in a modern philosophical text? I'm suggesting that ethics is a kind of perspective, it's a kind of method, it's a philosophical practice that we bring to the study of normativity, of human conduct, interpersonal conduct, conduct inter homines, as they say, between human beings. And if we think about ethics in this way, then it opens up a very wide field for where Jewish ethics can be found. You can find Jewish ethics in poems, in laws. You can find it in the Psalms, you can find it in Proverbs, you can find it in the Holiness Code, you can find it in Maimonides' Code, you can find it almost everywhere. Can you find it almost everywhere? Doesn't that mean that it's too expansive, it's too big? Perhaps we need to have a more restrictive concept. I think we do. If the concept includes everything, then it's absolutely useless. So how can we specify this notion of a Jewish ethics to make it more directive and more intellectually guiding? One thing I looked for in Jewish texts is something corresponding to the ethics, in the philosophical sense, morality distinction. That is, I looked for texts that seem to be aware of the arguments that they themselves are making. That is, texts that were involved in justifying a claim, arguing for a point of view. Part of what the book does is try to ferret out arguments that I think reside in texts, to try to uncover the rationality that's encoded in these cultural expressions. They're not arguments in a philosophical sense. When you open up a Platonic dialogue and see Socrates arguing with Euthyphro or somebody, and they have, you know, real claims going back and forth, but they are arguments of a kind that we're able to discover. So, my point is that a Jewish ethical text is a reflection on the primary matter of normativity, in some sort of ethical self-consciousness, let's say, that you can find in the text. What is this normativity that I'm talking about? Part of what you have to do when you, as you know, study other cultures, ancient cultures, predecessor cultures, is you have to suspend your own categories. You have to let the sources articulate their own categories, try to figure out what those categories are. Can you do this entirely? No. Otherwise, you'd simply be a medium through which some deceased spirit is speaking. You can't completely suspend the intellectual structures that you bring to text. So it's a balance. You want to try to figure out what the implicit rationality of a text is, but in order to do that, you have to have your own concept of what rationality would look like. So one of the things I try to do in the book is I try to suspend modern notions of what morality is. I try to suspend modern notions of what moral philosophy, what ethics is. I try to see to what extent I can let the Jewish texts define their own subject matter and suggest ways of understanding that subject matter. I'll give you an example of this. In our culture, it is common to make a distinction between rules of etiquette, rules of morality, and legal rules. If a parent says to a child, "Don't talk with your mouth full," we would say that is a rule of etiquette. That's not a moral principle, like keep your promises. And if you think of some legal norm, then you could set that at the other end. So we might say that there are these kind of increasing degrees of formality or coerciveness or publicity or some set of criteria we could work up to make these distinctions between these different species of normativity. The genus is the normative, and we come up with these different species. So we're very concerned to sort of set off morality from mere etiquette in an archaic society, from taboos. How do high normative matters like love your neighbor as yourself in Leviticus, how do they comport with matters of tumah and tahara, with purity, impurity, that kind of stuff? They seem to be very different sorts of things. So we have our own ways of categorizing normativity. What I try to do consistently in the book is to say there'd be a big mistake to take our notions of normativity and to superimpose them on the past. For one thing, it seems to me the distinction between law and ethics is powerfully modern distinctions. Not only a modern distinction, I think you can find the distinction at work elsewhere, but the sharpness that we give to the distinction seems to me to be a reflection of the omnipresence of the modern state, and that there's something fundamentally wrong about parsing a law-ethics distinction too sharply, or law-morality distinction too sharply. So I wouldn't want to make the move that some scholars of Jewish ethics make, which is to say, you have halakha here, and then you have this other stuff, principles like lifni mishurat adin, you know, don't make a full legal claim, but hold back. Nachmanides, Ramban, says in Deuteronomy, where there's the famous verse about, you know, you should do the good and the just. He says this is acting lifni mishurat hadin, not pressing full claim, of seeking compromise, things like that. So there's this tendency to say that Jewish ethics is sort of what's left over in the penumbra of the law. You have the law, and then you have this sort of nice stuff that's kind of epiphenomenal to it, and that's Jewish ethics. So you have a commentator like Michael Visegrad, an Orthodox thinker and a friend of mine, who writes in his book, The Body of Faith, ethics is the Judaism of the assimilated. As the really serious Jews, they, you know, they're all about law, if that's what halakha is. And ethics is, you know, tikkun olam, that kind of stuff that you fill sermons with in liberal synagogues. Okay, I see there's a point to it, but it seems to me it's dead wrong because it's based on a kind of methodological error in thinking about the relation between law and ethics. We could get into this more if you want, but I just want to make the claim that it doesn't do the student of Jewish ethics any good to cling to a hard distinction between law and ethics. What we should be talking about are expressions of normativity in different idioms. And any one of those expressions opens itself up to what Bernard Williams, the late British moral philosopher, teacher, by the way, of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, what Bernard Williams calls ethical considerations. We want to bring ethical consideration to texts with normative content. Okay, so what is this normative content? If it's not primarily its own thing, morality, that's distinct from law, distinct from etiquette, but it's sort of a broad range of human normative phenomena, how should we characterize it? One of the characteristics of modern thought about ethics is that there's a strong distinction between the right and the good. There's really a disjunction. Take one or the other, but you can't have both. What do I mean by this? A leading 20th century moral philosopher, probably the leading moral philosopher in the English-speaking world, John Rawls. John Rawls has a big book, came out in the early 70s, called Theory of Justice. Right? Probably the most important book in moral philosophy written in the last century. Theory of Justice. Justice has to do with public arrangements. It's public justice. It has to do with the constitutional arrangements of a society in which people are treated with fairness and that inequalities are minimized. Doesn't have anything to do with how people live. It has to do with how goods are distributed. That's what justice is about. It has to do with access. It has to do with process. It doesn't have to do with the soul, so to speak. It doesn't have to do, as Plato's Republic has to do, which is primarily about justice, with seeking the right order of the soul from which a just life follows. So how do we get from Plato to Rawls? I mean, Plato, we could say, is all concerned about the good. The Platonic or the Aristotelian question is really, how shall we live? What is the best life for human beings? That's the question that motivates ethical inquiry. for a modern like Rawls, the question is, how can society be fair? What are the most fair social arrangements? Are they even talking about the same thing? One is talking about the right, and the other is talking about the good. A person like Rawls wants to talk only about the right, and this really starts with Kant, with Immanuel Kant in the 18th century, because they don't believe that philosophy is able to answer the question, how shall we best live? What is the most human life? What's the best life for human beings? Those questions in the Western tradition get so monopolized by religion, with a religious, a theological anthropology, with the doctrine of what human beings really are, and therefore how human beings should really live. Modern thinkers in more secular veins will say those kinds of questions are off the table. There are infinite goods. People have different tastes. You know, for one person, you know, spending 7 hours a day with video games is the best way of life. For another person, listening to Beethoven string quartets is the best way of life. For another person, coming out in, you know, 32-degree weather and a November freak snowstorm to hear a lecture about abstruse methodological topics in Jewish philosophy is the best way. Who can say? There's no normative discourse of what the good truly is. It's radically atomized and individuated. So Rawls says that all of this has to be taken off the table. We can't talk about a comprehensive scheme of life. That's anti-democratic. Let people pursue their own ends in life. All we have to do is make sure that society is fair so they can do that. Well, that's very peculiar for an ancient author, or I would say for a Jewish author. So my claim in the book is that a well-formed inquiry into Jewish ethics has to look at two things. It has to look at the kinds of things that animate a Kant or a Rawls, that is, questions of right conduct. It also has to look at questions of character, of what human excellence is. We can all agree on some excellences, courage, classical Greek one, prudence. I think in the Jewish context we'd say chesed is a virtue, it's an excellence. But it's not just a question of coming up with a list of good things that we'd like to inculcate into our children or pursue in our own development. These have to relate to a vision of what human life is about. Charles Taylor, in his great book Sources of the Self, says that a self is what it stands for. A self is not a neutral concept. It's a value concept. It has to do with the virtues on which a life is staked. So it seems to me in the Jewish sources, ethics has to do with questions of the right and the good. And I try to show in the book, through looking at Jewish texts from many periods, that as concerned as Jewish thinkers have been for right conduct, for what constitutes proper behavior, there's also a deep concern for Shleimut, for our work toward improving and perfecting ourselves, particularly in the Musar strain of literature, not just the 19th century folks who took that name, but, you know, going back to medieval authors like Bakia ibn Pakuda, Maimonides, and others. So there's always this concern not only for how we should act, what the halakha is, but how we should, what should motivate us, what our ideals should be, what virtuous orientation we should try to pursue in our own life. That's not just something unique to Judaism. That's, I think, pretty common in the pre-modern period. It's only in modernity that these things fall apart. And I think, you know, one of the things that Jewish ethics can do for Western ethics is it can provide a model for how what one would call deontological considerations, considerations of duty, of justice, of right conduct, and aretaic considerations of virtue ethics, how they're conceptually held together. So if you do the right thing, but you do it with the wrong intention, or for the wrong reasons, have you really done the right thing? You know, how would you analyze such an act? I think the analysis in Jewish sources is ideally holistic. You look both to the duties of the limbs, as Bachio would say, and to the duties of the heart, too. One of the complaints made against modern ethics, particularly in the Anglo-American tradition, is that it's an ethics of mediocrity. It's not an ethics of perfectionism. It's not strenuous. There's nothing ascetic about modern ethics. Nobody has to sacrifice anything except occasionally put their self-interest on the back burner to do something charitable or compassionate or loving. Jewish ethics is strenuous, and in that sense, it's not terribly modern. I mean, when you read medieval sources that are all about a very serious vision of life, and you don't have a minute to waste, and everything has to be focused. It's a very, very different kind of mentality, and it's a mentality I think most of us would have a hard time living with today. But one of the claims I make in the book is that I think we need to recall it. I think we need, as Christians say, to be convicted by it. I think we need to see what, for people in our own tradition, Jewish tradition, constituted a serious, focused, committed life. It's easy to detract from such a strenuous ideal in an age of affluence, of relative affluence. Well, let me tell you just a few concrete things I do in the book. I realize this is a pretty methodological kind of argument I've been running here. There are recurrent problems in moral philosophy that we're familiar with from our Western sources. I'm interested in seeing how those recurrent problems crop up in Jewish sources. I think these are kind of pan-human problems that different cultures get at in their own way. So one enduring problem, I would say, is the problem of free will. To what extent, as beings who live in a natural world governed by natural forces, olam kaminhago noheg, I mean, however you analyze nature in a Jewish setting, easier to do in some kinds of sources than others, there are regularities. People have always observed regularities. We're part of those regularities. We share functions with animals. So what sense can we make of free will in a world of constraints? Constraints that run from gravity to hunger to alcohol that can boggle the mind. To what extent does the Jewish arguments rely on very robust versions of free will? I'm interested in this, and I kind of look for this everywhere. And there are a lot of places where free will determinism questions come up. They're very acute today in the age of neuroscience. The notion that the brain is a physical object and it obeys the laws of physics and any kind of radical indeterminacy that a strong free will position would seem to need doesn't make any sense. I mean, maybe it makes some sense on the quantum level, but what can you do with that? It's probably irrelevant. So what do we do with free will? The story about God hardening Pharaoh's heart in Exodus, that's one, you know, very typical place where you could say that's a way that the biblical text, even though it's not its maybe primary intent, but it's a place we can seize on to look at the free will determinism problem and the nature of free will and the assignation of blame, or responsibility, culpability, exculpating an actor, things like that. In medieval literature, it's sometimes much more self-consciously philosophical. Maimonides writes in at least three places about free will. So does Bachia. So does Shlomo Ibn Gabirol. Well, that's one kind of issue. Another issue that people in moral philosophy are concerned with, that I think the Bible deals with in its own way, and subsequent Jewish sources, is: are values real? And if they're real, in what sense are they real? Are values simply projections of human subjectivity, of preference? Does a value have the same status as a taste? You know, I like Pinot Noir, I don't like Pinot Grigio. I like not killing people, but, you know, so-and-so does like killing people. Is that all it comes down to? Are values facts about the world? Are values somehow embedded in reality in the same way that other things that we take to be fundamental to our experience of the real world are embedded? So I think there are texts that ask questions like this in their own way. In a specifically Jewish context, we're concerned about how much of normativity is discoverable by human intellect alone. I mean, do we sort of make ethics up? Do we figure it out? Do we read it off the world? Do we simply confect it in a society to help things run smoothly, as any, you know, group of social primates would do? They do this. Is that what it is? Or do we need revelation? You know, where does ethics come from? What does the Bible have to say about that? Perhaps a more theological way of putting this question of the status of values in reality is: do we need them to be revealed by God? Is that what gives them their reality? Or do we somehow intuit them, and if so, how? So that's a theme of the book. Another thing I look at through a lot of sources is self-interest. To what extent is moral action corrupted by self-interest? From a Kantian point of view, if you something that is ostensibly, superficially moral, like keep your promises, but you do it to enhance your reputation. Oh, you can trust him. He's an honest guy. You've vitiated the morality of the act.
Yeah.
From a utilitarian point of view, you're creating utility in the world. You're creating advantage. You're creating goodness. You're maximizing benefit for yourself and others in the world. So self-interest is okay. What are we to think of this polarity in Jewish sources? How should we look at that? Are Jewish sources from the Bible on up basically eudaimonistic? I mean, do they hold out a vision of life where if you do X, Y, and Z in the right spirit, then good things will happen to you and people in your society, and you'll get rain in your season, and it's a kind of very worldly, eudaimonistic kind of ethic? Well, Kant thought so, and he didn't therefore think too much of Jewish moral thought. He thought that it was sort of self-impeaching. So, you know, that leads to a whole host of ethical questions about self-interest, prudence, consequence, inherent rightness, things like that. And you can bring Jewish sources into dialogue with a philosopher like Kant. So that's a large part of what I do in the book. I try to create, similar to my earlier book on political thought in Judaism, I try to create conversations between Jewish texts and kind of canonical Western thinkers on selected moral problems. I try very hard in the book not to import my own agendas, the problems that interest me into texts. I don't try to marshal all of these texts just to make them work for, you know, for me. I really try to be attentive to what's in them, but there's no question that I've selected texts that I think have something morally interesting, ethically heuristic to say. So, like McIntyre's book, it's a short history. It's 200 pages, but it's still pretty short. It's a selective history, but I don't think it's a dramatically biased history. I pushed myself to learn about things I knew nothing about. And I tried to discover what was there. I found things that I really didn't like. At one point, studying Yisrael Salanter, the founder of the 19th century Musar movement, I felt ashamed to be a Litvak. I have to confess, I was so upset with Salanter. It just was a complete turnoff. But my approach to these things is, we shouldn't scant or slight their strangeness. We shouldn't domesticate what may be archaic or just very different, weird, to our own categories. Avoid that. On the other hand, don't romanticize or fetishize difference as if it were in itself precious and irretrievable. Always try to find the rationality that's working through these texts, making a kind of argument on behalf of a point of view, enter into a dialogue with it, and try to reconstruct it. Also thereby avoid historicism. To try to do history is different from historicism. That is, I've never been content with saying, okay, that's what they thought as best as we can determine, and it's pretty much irrelevant to what we think because it's different and foreign and inassimilable to us. I don't think human culture works that way. I mean, I think without trying to drag things into our orbit, to properly reconstruct the rationality that's at work in a cultural object, in an art object, in a text, is to enter into a dialogue with it and to see what your agreement can be, what your disagreement has to be, and to look at it from different angles. Okay, I think I've said enough. I hope that this, you know, gives you some little insight into the book. I understand from the publisher that Amazon is going to also market it as an audio book. I was telling Carol before, I'm hoping that James Earl Jones does the audio recording, or maybe Morgan Freeman would be okay too. But you may want to consider that some night when you're awake at 1:30 and you can't... Okay, that's enough for me. Yeah, sure.
We've got time for comments or questions.
Matt.
Yes. Ethics seems like it's more of an interpersonal realm, and I'm thinking about, did you address the issue of, say, policy? I mean, you talked about before Visegrad, and he says, well, there's Halakhan and there's Tikkun Olam, but did you see any kind of policy, so to speak, implications? I mean, one thing that I've been thinking a lot about is rich and poor, and just how this, you know, that in a sense, that's kind of built into the structure of the way that the Bible talks about. There's going to be rich and there's going to be poor. And how do you think about that in terms of an idea of redistribution, for example? This is just maybe an example of how maybe we could apply Jewish teachings to policy. Did you address that?
No, I really didn't. I did more of that in my book, The Scepter Shall Not Depart from Judah, the one on political theory. This really looks at conduct on an interpersonal level, as well as virtue on the level of what's the best life for human beings, what kind of character should we form. The one place I suppose I come close to talking like that is in the first chapter, which is called Ethics in the Axial Age. I didn't want to say biblical period. I use this term of art from the German philosopher Karl Jaspers, who after the war wrote a book about the so-called Axial Age. The Axial Age was his concept of how you had these great spiritual teachers who were active around the same time, like Buddha and Second Isaiah and Confucius and Lao Tzu in different parts of the world. What had gone on in ancient history and various civilizations with urbanization, the rise of an intellectual class, and so on, that led to a kind of moral enlightenment in different cultures, creating this sort of new intellectual sphere. I use that concept to look at how earlier Israelite conceptions of God as the kind of being who can walk in the garden in the cool of the day, those archaic conceptions get transformed into something much more transcendent, much more austere, much more moralized. And the kind of sinister of that moralization is the notion of tzedek and mishpat, that God is the ground of tzedek and mishpat. Societies are to be arranged on the basis of tzedek and mishpat. Lives are to be oriented by tzedek and mishpat, and the emulation of a God who's, you know, all of his ways are just. So I talk about this axial revolution. One of the ways that plays out is in the notion of a righteous kingship, a covenanted kingship, the Zion covenant with the Davidic line. That's about as close as I come to anything like that. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. I'm not sure if you answered the question while you were speaking, but one thing I can't get out of it is what distinguishes Jewish ethics from any other ethics? If you took a piece of text and if you looked at it and got any sense of it, would it tell you, if it were Jewish, you know, would it reflect that it was Jewish?
I think it depends on the sort of altitude from which you are looking at these things. If the altitude is high enough, that is, if your meta-ethical perspective is sufficiently abstract, then what you're going to pull out of the text will be sufficiently abstract so that it loses maybe some of its distinguishing features. That would be a mistake. One shouldn't do that. But I think the way my method plays out in this book is to some degree to be comparative. That is, I want to understand how Jewish thinkers have encountered problems that, you know, Greek and Roman and medieval Christian and Muslim thinkers have thought about, and how modern thinkers. So in the comparative work, you do lose some particularity. You do go to a higher altitude. On the other hand, I think one of the lessons of the book is that there's an ongoing moral tradition here. I mean, what is it to have a tradition? To have a tradition in a literary sense is to keep going back to the same texts, to have texts referencing texts that build on texts, to have this intergenerational conversation around foundational texts that continue to live. And I think we have that. I mean, just to give you an example, I don't really discuss this in the book. I'm not a big fan of Levinas, mostly because I just don't understand him all that well. I have my mind kind of comes to a halt at the Rhine. I have a hard time with the French.
There are bridges.
Yeah, I know. The first time I went to France, I drove over with a friend from Germany. We went to Strasbourg, and I said, "Oh, I'm finally in France." And my German friend said, "Not really." but you know, Levinas, who's a very important continental philosopher and a modern Jewish philosopher, he has this collection of philosophical engagements with sugyot of the Talmud, with Talmudic stories, with Talmudic law. There's one translation of them is called, by a friend of mine, it's called Nine Talmudic Readings. We had a course in it last year here. Mm-hmm. So here you have, a late 20th century figure going back to Talmudic texts to do his version of philosophical ethics. That, to me, is participation in a tradition. It's interesting that after McIntyre wrote this book, he repudiated it. It took him a few years, but he basically said, don't read this book. This book is based on... I think you should read this book, McIntyre notwithstanding. But he, from his point of view, it was based on a faulty philosophical method. That is, he followed his Victorian British... predecessors in taking all of these great Western moral philosophers and putting them between two covers and trying to make a coherent tradition out of it. And he later came to the view in his Gifford lectures, the three rival versions of moral inquiry, that there's such fundamental disagreement in the West that you can't talk about it as one tradition. To take Thomas Aquinas, let's say, and Friedrich Nietzsche, both moral philosophers, and to think that they're talking about the same thing is wrong. That from his point of view, they are ensconced in traditions that are absolutely distinct from one another and are incommensurable. You can't compare them, and they can't speak to each other given their premises about what human beings are, how human beings should live. So I think one of the advantages of looking at Jewish ethics is that you can write a history of it. You can see it, despite its immense internal diversity, as working within a kind of broad geography set by foundational texts that everyone has to go back to.
I'm still not sure what makes it Jewish as opposed to anything else. I'm not sure. I'm not. I don't have a handle on that. What you said, though, has spurred something in here.
I think, I think that's one of those philosophical muddles that one should try to avoid.
Darn it.
People write books about this. What is Jewish literature? What is Jewish art? It's in the nature of asking those questions, a typical Socratic question, what is... that we expect answers. It may be that there are no answers, at least not the kind of answer that you'd expect, that these are just ongoing negotiations about what we think we can claim and what reasons we have for making those claims. But I would say, other than appeal to a shared body of texts, many of them written in the Hebrew language, I'm not sure it's one could press for more than that. I mean, your question might be, Are there distinctive values that Jews prize that others don't prize? Some Jews at some times. I don't think there's a big profit margin in pursuing that question.
Profit. I think
Sylvia.
Thank you.
I understand you're struggling with the word Jewish, and I'm struggling with the word ethics. The ethics that I studied as part of studying public administration and management classes was always sort of separating the philosophy from the applied ethics. And it's like, well, just pick one and go with it. Sort of what I was thinking about in a very practical degree, sort of like pick a system of ethics and then apply it. I find it even more difficult within trying to understand what Jewish ethics might be. When you try to separate the philosophical from the applied, because was the intention of a Jewish code of anything, was that distinction ever appropriate to have a philosophy and an applied? I mean, my understanding of Torah, it was always sort of like, it's there so you can do it, so you can kind of live it. It's always meant to be applied. So kind of separating the notion between the philosophical and the applied, in a sense, is something that
I'm struggling with. As I had mentioned, the word ethics and the word morals are often used interchangeably. And when we talk about discrete bodies of professional ethics, journalistic ethics, medical ethics, codes of ethics in that sense, we're really talking about bodies of morality that are adequate for some group of persons engaged in some specified task. So that is not a usage of ethics in the philosophical sense of moral philosophy, of upper-level reflection on human conduct. That's part of the willingness of language that we find in ordinary language. Philosophers talk about descriptive ethics, normative ethics, and meta-ethics. Descriptive ethics would be when you look at a group of people and see how they're acting, and perhaps get to talk with them, you could be an anthropologist and try to understand why they do what they do, what values are motivating them, why they think those values are genuine values, why they rate some values above other values. If there's a conflict of values, how do they decide which value should prevail? You can do a description of that. At a higher level, a so-called normative ethics level, you could say, they think that this practice is supremely valuable. My group thinks that this practice is really a disvalue. We don't do that. That's invidious. We don't like that. Who's right? Is there any way that, are we both right? I mean, is it relativism? Or are there some fundamental principles like human rights that make this particular action right and that one not? When there was the Soviet Union, we would say to the Soviet Union, well, you don't have freedom of religion, you don't have freedom of assembly, you don't have freedom of the press. And they would say, yeah, well, you don't have guaranteed health care, you don't have guaranteed employment, we have our values. A normative ethical program would try to make an argument on behalf of some particular normative agenda and some way of being moral. Meta-ethics, the sort of intellectual nosebleed level, is asking the kind of questions that I asked before, like what makes right acts right, whether rightness is a property of action, is it inherent, is it ascribed, what's the ontology of this? If you want to think about Jewish ethics as highly applied matters, what to do, read Joseph Telushkin. In a way, he's giving you an insider's guide to descriptive Jewish ethics. it's a modern code of Jewish ethics in, I don't know, two or three volumes. It's pretty good. It's laid out by, you know, big categories like the ethics of speech. You know, so if you want to figure out, you know, well, I'd like to say this because it'll spare somebody's feelings, but technically it's not quite true. Is that a lie? Am I lying? You know, he'll pull all of this stuff together for you, and you can kind of think it out. That's applied ethics, or as I'm calling it, descriptive ethics. But if you want to think in a more philosophically critical way of the issues that lie behind those choices you make at the applied level, and see how that normative reflection works itself out in Jewish sources, that's more what this book is trying to do. So one choice I made in writing this was, I said, well, you know, I could have come up with something that I could track across a lot of texts and a lot of periods. I don't know, let's say Jews and Gentiles, or men and women, or some content that's, you know, fraught with ethical significance. And I could just lay it out in a lot of texts. And there would, I think you could make a compelling case for writing such a book, but I didn't want to do that. Because I thought it would be philosophically less interesting than just going to a lot of texts and trying to see what the root issues are and how to reconstruct them. But I think that would be a good book to write in a historical key.
I think yours is harder.
It wasn't harder. That other book would have been harder for me to write, in a sense, because I sort of think like this, but I think it does make for a slightly harder book. I think the publisher would have been very happy with a textbook that could be used in an introductory class. But the reviews of this book so far have been, for the most part, this is a good book, but you need to bring philosophical background to it to get as much out of it as it has to offer. It's not... You know, it makes some demands on the reader to sort of be alert to philosophical questions in ethics.
One last question.
Okay. Ma'am?
You speak about Judaism, you speak about philosophy. What about the ethical fable of Spinoza?
I treat Spinoza in here. He does get a few pages. I have a chapter on early modern thinkers, and everyone has to make a decision about Spinoza. Is he in or is he out? I think these days most people believe that he's in. Karl Marx is out. Freud, he's kind of in and out. But Spinoza's in, because even though Spinoza drops out in a social sense, even though Spinoza, in some ways, is a kofer be'ikar, I mean, he really sort of chops Judaism off at the roots in some ways. In other ways, he very much continues the medieval project of ethics cum metaphysics cum anthropology in a post-medieval idiom. And I think ultimately Spinoza wants some of the same things that, say, a Maimonides would want or a Kreskos would want. So I think with all due caution, one should include Spinoza. He certainly has an impact on later Jewish thinkers. I mean, the German Romantics and the Jews who sort of follow them brought Spinoza out of obscurity, and they made him this kind of heroic figure, a very influential figure in Weimar and then Hitler Germany. Leo Beck, the leader of liberal Judaism, he actually wrote his dissertation on the reception of Spinoza in Germany. So I think one of the philosophers working today, whom I consider to be the deepest, most intriguing Jewish philosophers, really rather Spinozist. I mean, I think he he retranslates Spinoza into somewhat of a more pious idiom. So I think Spinoza's worth including, and I've included him a little bit.
Thank you.
So it would be unethical for us to keep you any later than we already have. It's surely unethical of me to do what I'm about to do, which is in an act of shameless self-promotion, self here meaning the library. Since you mentioned Joseph Telushkin, he's done a lot of his work just hanging out in our stacks. And so if you want to meet really interesting people and find a lot of good books, come out and hang out in our stacks. And if you are interested in Jewish books, this was a Jewish book talk. I can say that with confidence because the word Jewish is right here on the front, and it's at an institution called the Jewish Theological Seminary by a fellow who, as far as I know, is Jewish. So come back in 3 weeks for a similar such Jewish book talk by another one of our faculty members, Professor Jeffrey Kress from the Department of Jewish Education. If you're interested in the way we consider that very central question, I'm sure you'll enjoy it very much. So please come back and have a safe trip home.
Thank you, David, very much. Not bad on 3 hours of sleep.